Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Tuesday, December 8th. Yesterday was Pearl Harbor Day in America. Today is Safe Harbor Day. On Pearl Harbor Day, we remember that 2,403 Americans were killed in a sneak attack by Japan on December 7, 1941. This year, for the week ending December 7th, an average of 2,259 Americans died each day from the coronavirus, according to the New York Times COVID tracker. We're basically having a Pearl Harbor every day in this country now. After Pearl Harbor, the U.S. entered World War II, despite protests by a group who said they stood for America First. Today, public health officials are asking people to stay home and close risky businesses temporarily, despite protests led by the president who says he stands for America First. Yesterday was Pearl Harbor Day, December 7th. Today is Safe Harbor Day, December 8th. According to a Washington Post article published just after midnight as Safe Harbor Day began, it's called Safe Harbor Day because it's a kind of insurance policy by which a state can lock in its electoral votes by finishing up certification of the results and any state court legal challenges by a congressionally imposed deadline, which this year is today. The article notes that other than Wisconsin, every state appears to have met today's deadline in federal law that essentially means Congress has to accept the electoral votes that will be cast next week and sent to the Capitol for counting on January 6th. Those votes, the article says, will elect Joe Biden as the country's next president, that from the Washington Post today. But as with so much else about this year's election, President Trump is trying to nullify Safe Harbor Day by working the political system around it. Another Washington Post article today says President Trump called the Speaker of the Pennsylvania House of Representatives, a man named Brian Cutler, twice during the past week to make an extraordinary request for help reversing his loss in that state, reflecting a broadening pressure campaign, says the Washington Post, by the president and his allies to try to subvert the 2020 election result. The article says a spokesman for Cutler says Cutler told the president that the legislature has no power to overturn the state's chosen state of electors, but, ominously, that same article says that late last week, that same Pennsylvania House Speaker, Mr. Cutler, was among about 60 Republican state lawmakers who sent a letter to Pennsylvania's congressional delegation urging them to object to the state's electoral slate on January 6th when Congress is set to formally accept the results. And it says, although such a move is highly unlikely to gain traction, at least one Pennsylvania Republican, Congressman Scott Perry, said in an interview yesterday that he will heed the request and dispute the state's electors in Congress. Dispute Pennsylvania's electors in Congress. So how safe is Safe Harbor Day? With me now, Aaron Blake, political reporter for the Washington Post politics section, known as The Fix. Aaron, thanks for coming on WNYC, and happy Safe Harbor Day, if it is a happy Safe Harbor Day.
Happy Safe Harbor Day, Brian. Thanks for having me on.
So your article today is about three court rulings in one day yesterday from Michigan and Georgia getting in under the wire before today's Safe Harbor deadline. All three court rulings offering brutal or scathing rebukes of the president's claims, your words. Can you tell us about the one from the two federal judges who Trump has considered for the Supreme Court?
Yeah, maybe this was the least surprising of the ones we're talking about here, but significant nonetheless. Bill Pryor is an appeals court judge who was on the president's shortlist for Supreme Court dating back to when he was first a candidate. Of course, he's been passed over for those. And then the other judge who took part in this decision was Barbara Lagoa, who was maybe the chief competitor to Amy Coney Barrett this last time around when Barrett was selected for the Supreme Court. So basically, those two presidential Supreme Court shortlisters ruled against a suit by Lynn Wood, a Trump-aligned attorney in Georgia, seeking to decertify that state's election results. Now, not a terribly surprising outcome, given this was kind of a Hail Mary, but I think it's very worth noting that the president's legal effort, and this is something we saw in these other cases we're talking about in this article, has forced allies or people who you'd think to be allied with the president or at least sympathetic to him in certain ways to rule against him and not go along with his claims. And I think we've seen that most demonstrably in Georgia, especially with Brian Kemp, the governor, who, of course, has long been a Trump ally.
Yeah, very interesting stuff in Georgia. And now with these two judges, federal judges, who, for anybody who did follow the Supreme Court nomination process, those names, Pryor and Lagoa, were in the news and reportedly very high on the president's list before he actually chose Kavanaugh and then Amy Coney Barrett. All right. In the other case in Georgia, you note that the opposition to the president filed its case in court representing Republican Governor Brian Kemp, who used to be a close ally of Trump's. Trump now rips him every day. And Kemp's rebuttal to the president includes what you call the pièce de résistance involving a mythological monster. What is that mythological monster?
Well, since the start of this whole process, of course, Sidney Powell, who was for a brief period on Trump's legal team, then was excommunicated for reasons that aren't entirely clear, made a bunch of very far-flung claims about a communist plot and Venezuela and Hugo Chavez. She's called her election contests the Kraken. She said she's releasing the Kraken, which, of course, is a mythological monster that doesn't actually exist, which is something that Brian Kemp's legal team made a very pointed note of in their filing this weekend. They said that, much like the mythological Kraken monster, after which plaintiffs have named this lawsuit, their claims of election fraud and malfeasance belong more to the Kraken's realm of mythos than they do to reality. Brian Kemp has not been willing to go along with what the president has asked of him, clearly. But like many other Republican politicians, he has been treating the president with kid gloves, not necessarily disputing these things forcefully, but just saying that it's not within his power to do anything else, essentially. I think that this response over the weekend, which actually happened the same day that the president called Brian Kemp, apparently trying to apply some pressure, really crystallizes the manner in which these Republican officials have not been willing to go along with what the president wants them to do.
Right. And yes, listeners, we're going to get to the big but section of this interview in a few minutes. But what about Congress members like Scott Perry from Pennsylvania being willing to overturn these electoral vote outcomes? But first, we're going through these three various court rulings yesterday that seem to help put nails in the coffin of the president's cases. And we've got one more to go with Aaron Blake from The Washington Post. You have a few juicy quotes in your article from this judge's ruling in Michigan, including that the pro-Trump case consisted of, quote, nothing but speculation and conjecture, that votes for President Trump were destroyed, discarded, or switched to votes for Vice President Biden, unquote. In other words, a Michigan judge yet again has ruled that they have no evidence?
Yeah, this was maybe the most significant of the three rulings that we saw in the last several days here. This was a district judge named Linda Parker, who, you know, like many judges before her, has essentially said there is no real evidence here. This is based upon hearsay. But I think what was most interesting about her decision was when she kind of speculated a little bit about the purpose behind the lawsuit. She said that she didn't necessarily believe that it was actually about changing the results of the election. Indeed, the lawsuit was filed rather late for that purpose. She said, quote, she thought that it was more about the impact of the allegations on people's faith in the democratic process and their trust in government. I think this has been a question throughout this effort, whether the president truly believes that he can overturn this election result, or whether this is merely a means to rally his base, to claim that he never lost, and to build a political movement moving forward. And I think the judge really nodded to that second possibility in this decision in a way that we haven't necessarily seen the courts do before.
Judge, as political analyst, is the timing here relevant, the fact that this latest trio of losses for the president in court came on the day before Safe Harbor Day?
Yeah, I think obviously the Safe Harbor deadline is a significant one because legally speaking, states aren't allowed to change their results after that. They're not allowed to change the electors that they send for the Electoral College. So these did need to be resolved in some fashion before then. I think more than anything, though, this trio of rulings is a reflection of the desperation that we're seeing from the legal teams behind these lawsuits, and the judges seem to have less and less patience for that, for the tactics that they're using to really throw things at the wall and hope that they stick.
But Aaron, here's the money question. As far as you can tell, how safe is Safe Harbor Day really? Because that other Washington Post article about Pennsylvania, as we cited at the beginning, said Trump has called the Speaker of the Pennsylvania House of Representatives, Brian Cutler, twice in the last week, asking him to help overturn the outcome in the state. And Cutler did write to Pennsylvania's congressional delegation asking them to do so. And one of those members of Congress, Republican Congressman Scott Perry, said he will. So I'm confused. How safe is Safe Harbor Day from Republican Party politics in Congress if they want to go down that road?
Well, as with so much of what we're going through right now, it's just unprecedented in many ways. We haven't seen this kind of an electoral contest for a race that, yes, was decided by less than 1% in the decisive states, but it's not a situation in which there really seems to be any question, at least what the evidence shows, when it comes to the fact that Joe Biden won this. So we have a deadline coming up, not just Safe Harbor Day today, but December 14th, when the electors in these states will formally cast their votes. Then we have the January 6th date, which is when Congress will convene. There, I'm guessing, are going to be a number of members. You mentioned Scott Perry from Pennsylvania. Mo Brooks from Alabama has been saying many of the same things about this, who are going to try to object. But the math for Republicans just really isn't there in the House. It would take something extraordinary for the results to actually change. I think, again, we're talking about something that's more in the realm of making a political statement and building a movement than something that actually has a possibility of overturning the results.
All right. Well, that's going to be reassuring to a lot of Democrats. And you kind of answered what was going to be my next question, which is whether you all at the Fix or elsewhere at the Washington Post politics desk done a head count of congressional Republicans and what they'll do on January 6th, because someone did one the other day that found a majority of Republicans in Congress won't say out loud that Biden won the election. You saw that, right?
Yeah. So our story surveyed every Republican in the House and the Senate, about 250 members in total, and asked them three questions. The first was, do you recognize that Joe Biden won this election? Will you accept it if Joe Biden wins the Electoral College? And the overwhelming response was no comment. We had 25 members who said that they believed Joe Biden won the election. Only two said that they believed Trump won, which I think is telling in its own way. But the vast majority are keeping their powder dry. And that's really a reflection of how uneasy this is for Republicans. They don't want the president's wrath. They don't want to take a position on this until they actually have to. And I think it's just a, you know, it's one of those things where we talk about the Brian Kemps of the world. We talk about the Secretary of State in Georgia, Brad Raffensperger, who have kind of, yes, a Republican, who have become front and center in this because they've certified their state's results. Well, the reason they've been front and center is because they've had no choice. They've been involved in this and they had to make some kind of a decision. These other Republicans, until they have to make that decision, have overwhelmingly declined to get involved at all. What's going to be interesting is if Mo Brooks and Scott Perry do press this issue when things actually come to Congress, just how many Republicans are going to go along with it, because at that point, they will have to make some kind of a decision about the sanctity of the election and the validity of the election results.
Here are a couple of questions via Twitter that are along the same lines as each other. One of them says, aren't these suits and calls to Republican politicians just a money grab by Trump appealing to the base for money? And another one says, Trump always has a personal financial motivation. I'd love if you asked your guest if the 75% of political donations he can legally keep in his own bank account figures into his calculus.
There's no question that this has been a huge, huge fundraising boon for the president. His campaign has sent about 500 fundraising emails just since Election Day. We had financial reports, the post-election financial reports this week, that showed he had raised more than $200 million in that period just since the election. That's a number that, you know, used to be enough to run an entire presidential campaign, much less a post-election effort. So I think that it's clear that regardless of the success of challenging the election results, this has given the president the money to continue being an entity in politics. As the questioner mentioned, 75% of these donations can go to his political action committee, 25% goes to the Republican National Committee, and only if a donor gives more than $6,000 does that money actually go to the official legal defense fund. So this is pretty clearly an effort that is geared less towards the legal defense than it is towards a broader, continued presence for the president and also the Republican Party. And it's been very successful, at least in that regard.
Gerard in Queens, you're on WNYC with Aaron Blake from The Washington Post. Hi, Gerard.
Yes, hi. My question is, prior to the campaign, we heard that the Biden team had scores of lawyers ready to fight any legal challenge brought up by the Trump campaign and as to the legitimacy of the vote. And now that we've heard that the Republicans have basically lost every fight that they've had, have the Democrats had to play defense in any of these cases, or have they just been summarily just shot down by the courts and just because the Trump campaign's argument has been so lame or deficient? I'm just wondering, the Biden team that we heard was ready to, you know, go out there and fight. Have they had to do anything?
Well, I think Mark Elias is the big Democratic election lawyer, has been around for a very long time, has kind of been spearheading this from a national perspective. He hasn't been involved in these cases on a personal basis because they're all over the country, and that would be very difficult for him to do. I think that the questioner is right that this is a lot about the complete lack of evidence that we've seen here, maybe more so than the genius of the Democrats' legal defense strategy here. The judges have over and over again not just rejected the claims, but basically called them baseless and said that there was nothing to substantiate them. And so when you bring a case to court, the lawyers on the opposite side can be very good at what they do. And undoubtedly, Democrats did lots of preparation for what we're seeing now because the president telegraphed it for a long time. But I think the prevailing picture of what we've seen over the last 4 weeks here has been there's just not a whole lot to these lawsuits. There's just nothing there to grab hold of and really for the judges to struggle in any significant way with these questions.
Here are two more tweets from two different listeners that are in a theme. One of them from somebody tweeting as, "Beware swooping from randoms." Beware swooping from randoms writes, "Let's talk about the political bet that undoing the votes of the actual majority will be a gain. It stuns me," writes that listener. In other words, that it could be a political gain to undo the will of the majority of the people in America if they were to actually do that. And then another one is aimed at me from a listener, and it says, "I think you misspoke a moment ago when you said Democrats will be relieved that there's no chance of overturning the election. This is about our democracy, not about what party you're in. A lot of people who aren't Democrats will be relieved." So, Aaron, my question to you is, does your reporting bear that out? Because I see these surveys of Republicans, 70%, 75%, 80% in these surveys say they believe the election was stolen by Biden.
Yeah, and this is the question, politically speaking, of this effort for Republicans. Is it ultimately wise when it comes to appealing to people in the broader electorate, or is it just a very concerted base strategy? And of course, the president throughout his time in office and dating back to the 2016 campaign has been basically only concerned with that base strategy. And I think we saw in the 2020 election the limits of that. Now, it was as I said, it was a close election in the decisive states, but a significant popular vote margin for the Democrats, certainly. One of the biggest anti-incumbent votes that we've seen in many decades in American politics. So, you know, you do wonder how much that base strategy is what the Republicans want to do going forward. At the same time, they are hamstrung by the president's whims. They are hamstrung by what the president does because they don't feel like they can speak out against him in public, and thus they can't really arrest the momentum of this legal challenge in any real way. And so my suspicion is that a lot of political consultants in the Republican Party and the ones that I've talked to are less comfortable with this than the president's advisors are. But whether it's ultimately something that is going to swing votes in future elections or really turn off independent voters from the Republican Party moving forward, I think is an unsettled question. Certainly, we've seen Republicans be competitive in politics by being pretty ruthless when it came to stuff like the Supreme Court.
Last thing in our last minute, Giuliani got diagnosed with COVID. He had been maskless in close contact with people from three state legislatures where he participated in those various hearings in the last week, Arizona, Michigan, and Georgia. He was maskless. He was in a closed room, speaking loudly. Obviously, that projects Rudy droplets. He was hugging people. People were taking their photos with him, all this stuff. I see the entire Arizona legislature has now been ordered to quarantine until they can get negative tests after a number of days. I don't know if the same thing is happening in Michigan and Georgia. But how's Giuliani? And I hear that he's going to keep pressing this case from his hospital bed.
Yeah, it makes me think back to the tail end of the campaign when the president came down with the coronavirus and several people around him in the White House also came down with it. It took him off the campaign trail for a couple of weeks, and that the campaign trail is what he loves. So there certainly is a little bit of irony here when it comes to how the coronavirus has sidelined the president late in the campaign, now appears to be sidelining his lawyer late in this process, also sidelining the legislatures in Pennsylvania and Arizona. I don't know that they would have done anything differently, even if they were in session, but certainly the fact that this is kind of the coda to this legal effort when it comes to how kind of laissez-faire and how much they haven't been wearing masks in these hearings, I think is really a pretty telling end to that whole process.
Aaron Blake from the Washington Post politics section and blog called The Fix. They also put out email newsletters under the name The Fix. Aaron, thanks for the clarity.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at wnyc.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.